Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show.
The nice thing about being in a pod for car owners is you do just have a steadier stream of foot traffic. You probably get more exposure. So, you know, it's kind of about like how much you can deal with, you know, and like what the alternative is. Is the alternative going to somewhere cheaper where you might have better services, but, you know, it's on 141st and there's no foot traffic. So I think it's always a game of, you know, what am I willing to give up?
You already know Portland has a world-renowned food truck scene. There are more than 500 food carts in Portland, and nearly 90 pods, or lots, where the trucks operate. Local laws prohibit food carts from operating on the street, instead requiring that they park themselves in these empty, unregulated lots, such as the Hawthorne Asylum, owned by Steve Johnson and, after his passing, his son Brock, who would sooner decorate the pod with a family mural than install functioning toilets. Landlords, am I right? It's Saturday, May 21st, and this is episode 72 of The Dive. Pod Complex is this week's cover story, brought to us by reporter Sophie Peel. In her piece, Sophie breaks down how lax regulations around the necessary lots that house one of Portland's greatest attractions, its food cart scene, are potentially giving landlords a free pass to be just as hands-off as they want to be. An example of this dynamic is the popular pod, the Hawthorne Asylum, where cart owners allege neglected toilets, garbage overflow, and a custodian that the landlords housed on-site in an unused shipping container. Before Sophie and I break down just how much pod owners get away with as landlords, I'll speak to Rachel Saslow about her contribution to this week's issue, a piece that examines the radicalization of Michael Bivens, a former WW contributor whose hate crimes against two synagogues and a mosque came as a shock to the contemporaries that he worked with as a freelance journalist covering Portland street riots. First, let's kick things off with a quick look at what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. Portland barely used 16% of the federal funding it received to provide emergency housing for its unhoused residents, and Home Forward, a local public housing agency, is making especially dismal progress, and they can't explain why. Regardless, they still received an additional $2 million to ease rent debt. All right, y'all, Nigel Jaquess is watching you, so maybe have better results this time, or at least a legitimate reason for not delivering. The Northwest Grocery Association has withdrawn their petition to sell hard liquor at grocery stores. So if you're desperate for a bundle of produce and a bottle of tequila, but only want to interact with one cashier, I'm afraid that you're going to have to go to the Couve. On the plus side, those grocery stores stack mad bottles. 3 hours after this week's paper went to press, I learned of Joanne Hardesty's strong showing in the race to maintain her position on Portland City Council. Congratulations, Joanne, and good luck in the November runoff. Michael Bivens was a freelance journalist who covered Portland extremism before emerging as a violent extremist himself. Fellow freelancer Rachel Saslow and I will unpack his strange spiral now as we discuss her contribution to this week's issue. What happened to Michael Bivens?
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Rachel?
I'm good.
So, for the uninitiated, who is Michael Bivens, and why is his story important?
Sure. Mike Bivens got some notoriety a few years ago for being one of the people who took video of protests in the streets in Portland between Antifa and the far right and the Proud Boys. And whenever there was a big clash, he was pretty much there with his phone filming, and he had a lot of followers on Twitter. But he was a trained journalist. He went to journalism school at Portland State. He had an internship at Eugene Weekly. He was a real journalist. And then around 2019, he kind of dropped off the face of journalism and wasn't really reporting anymore. But then in the last year, his Twitter account took a sharp turn, and he started saying things that were pretty hateful. it seemed like he had gone down some sort of rabbit hole that was pretty dark. And then allegedly at the beginning of May, he went on a hate crime spree where he is charged with breaking windows at two different synagogues, writing anti-Semitic slurs on one synagogue, trying to set fire to a mosque, and breaking a window of a black-owned business. So it was a whole week and many, many crimes that he's charged with. Oof.
So when you're putting together this story, you spent a lot of time on his Twitter.
I did.
What was the impression that you were left with after spending like 2 days on this guy's Twitter?
I spent a lot of time on his Twitter. Well, I could only go back as far as maybe about 6 months. I think he changed his Twitter handle around then, and I couldn't go back any further. Luckily, some of the sources I had been taking screenshots of the more inflammatory things because I think they just had the instinct, like, this isn't going to turn out good. So they were worried about him and were taking some screenshots. So I have some of the further back stuff, but it's just really dark. And in the article, I didn't want to give a lot of oxygen to some of his more hateful things. I didn't want to just use a newspaper as a platform for him to spread his words further. So the way I wrote it was just, you know, he said very disturbing things about, and then I just listed like five groups, like Jews, black people, Spanish speakers, people with disabilities. I mean, he really hit every group with nastiness. So I did spend so much time on his Twitter that I had a nightmare about it one night during reporting.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
As you're going through his Twitter, was it this kind of slow development of these opinions? Like, was it just like something snapped on and all of a sudden he was a bigot? Or did you kind of see it building and building and building into something?
I think if I had access to his Twitter for longer than the last 6 to 8 months, I think I would have seen a slower build. Mm-hmm. Other people on Twitter said they saw some misogyny starting maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But it was pretty swift. I mean, you know, a lot, he has people who really follow protests. He has about 10,000 followers. And so people kind of saw this all unravel in real time. So a lot of people have kind of seen the downward spiral. Mm-hmm. He actually only follows two Twitter accounts. He follows Elon Musk and Chick-fil-A.
What?
I mean, read into it what you will.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to conflate racism and bigotry with mental illness, but what did your reporting lead you to discover about Mike's like his headspace at the time that the crimes were committed?
Sure. Officially, through police documents, he reported no diagnosed mental health issues. His ex-wife confirmed that and said he does not have a history of mental illness. So on the record, that's as much as I got.
Yeah. During the course of your reporting, how do I say this? Did you get the impression that maybe somehow Mike's work with local media maybe influenced his crimes? Like, what I'm trying to say is, do you think that maybe radicalization occurred as a result of being exposed to the kind of vitriol in the protests that he was covering?
That is a huge question for me. I would love to know the answer to it because it does seem, you know, that's just one of the theories I was working with, was like in terms of what happened. Like, was he in these far right protest circles for so long that eventually the rhetoric like got in? And unfortunately, that's not an answer that I got in my reporting.
Well, another thing that came to mind was whether or not these acts were like performed as a kind of like a false flag kind of moment, like he was trying to start a riot, tip the city into further chaos.
I I don't know. It would sort of be all speculation. I didn't really get anything from my reporting nor in the police reports that kind of got at a bigger picture.
My first thought was like, does this happen to freelancers? You just get caught up in the muck of things and then they just spiral out of control. Is this going to happen to me? Oh my gosh.
It is kind of strange. Like, he's a Willamette Week freelancer. I'm a Willamette Week freelancer. I was interviewing at least two other freelancers, you know? It's a bizarre path.
Okay, so what surprised you most about reporting this piece?
I think the things that were the most impactful for me in reporting this piece were the damage done to the communities. And I really tried to keep those things at the forefront when I was doing my reporting, that there was real, even though, you know, these buildings will be repaired, nobody was hurt, thank God, even though, you know, there were people in the mosque when he tried to set it on fire. Yeah. So, you know, people really could have been hurt, but nobody was. The buildings will be repaired. But I think that that sense of safety is being shattered is, and those are communities that their sense of safety was not exactly like airtight to begin with. You know what I mean? So it was hard.
Thanks, Rachel. Now let's catch up with Sophie Peel and discuss her cover story, Pod Complex. Hello, Sophie. Thank you for joining me today. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good.
So this week you wrote about the conditions at the Hawthorne Asylum food cart pod and how even though the food carts are held to the same standards as like brick and mortar restaurants, the lots that they occupy are not. What led you to the discovery of this story?
It was brought to us by a former food cart owner, and you know, from there I just started reaching out to all the other former food cart owners and some current ones as well, pretty much anyone who'd be up for chatting with me in any capacity about, you know, the conditions there and what their time was like at the Hawthorne Asylum. And so I ended up, I think in total, talking to 10 former and current food cart owners there, who all, for the most part, well, nearly all of them had you know, pretty similar concerns about unsanitary conditions at the Hawthorne Asylum. So that spanned from, you know, porta potties that were smeared with feces at times and had really inconsistent cleanings. There, you know, last year, about mid 2021, the landlords of the property stopped taking care of recycling. And so all of the carts had to deal with their own recycling. And as you can imagine, in any food establishment, you've just got tons of boxes. And
sure.
So, you know, on any day, there's just boxes, these soggy boxes out in the rain pretty next to every cart. Trash was, you know, oftentimes overflowing. I mean, there were just sort of like a whole host of issues. There were a few other ones that, you know, or I think are probably specific to the Hawthorne Asylum. I mean, they had employed a houseless man for a time and had him living in a shipping container on the plot of land and paying him a undisclosed amount of money. I have an estimate of 200 to 500. I was not able to confirm exactly what that was, but so I think there were just sort of a litany of issues that they had.
But I had driven past, I don't know, like a couple of weeks ago, and I think maybe like a week to the day that the story came out. Driving past the Hawthorne Asylum and thinking, wow, that place looks so cool. I live in the Northeast, so I have my own pod in my own neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But we drove past the asylum and I was like, I cannot wait to take visiting friends here. Wow, when did this place pop up? Mm-hmm. And the next week, cover story by Sophie Peel.
I will say, you know, I spent an hour with the owner and then also the pod manager, and I mean, I would say first they characterized the cart owners' concerns as being blown out of proportion, which, you know, I don't agree with. I don't think they're blown out of proportion. That being said, it seems like they have done some things that may have righted some of the issues. Just last week, they installed permanent bathrooms.
Oh, nice.
I guess that's probably the big improvement. You know, another big concern for a lot of those cart owners, too, was they were, at this point, they're paying $2,945 for rent. So it's in kind of getting into the regulation part of it, too, is that these landlords really don't have to provide many services for their tenants. You know, like they don't have to provide pest management or regular trash and recycling services. They don't have to provide adequate bathrooms. And so it's kind of like you're in this tenant landlord relationship, but like the landlord really isn't required by law to provide any services that any other tenant anywhere would expect.
Yeah.
So it's like a very, very expensive parking space. I mean, I will say I actually, in talking to county regulators who visit CARTs all the time because they have regular inspections, you know, they've been at a lot of these pods, not inspecting the pods themselves, but inspecting the CARTs. So they kind of have an understanding of the lay of the land. They estimate there's 70 to 90 pods across the county, which kind of blew my mind. Like, I figured it was something like 20 to 30 at tops. So they've seen everything, and they said that the Hawthorne Asylum is not necessarily an outlier. There are ones that are ran much better. There's one that are much worse.
Oh my.
So I think it is a huge spectrum, largely because they are unregulated. There's very few standards they're held to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was looking at other pods. I was talking to other pod owners and kind of getting the lay of the land, and you know, the county health department as well. I mean, again, they had so much insight, and they were really able to share, you know, just kind of the variety of pod owners out there. And I remember asking them, like, is there, if you could pinpoint sort of like the person, like when you think of a pod owner, who it is it some, you know, old white dude who owns a lot of downtown real estate? Is it some, you know, hippie dude? Like, who is it? Mm-hmm. And they were like, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
I think the history of pods is really interesting. They really started popping up during the recession around 2008 and the couple years after that, because, you know, landowners who had bought land and maybe had a mortgage on that, you know, they were having a hard time actually getting developers, and they're like, well, I've got this empty plot of land. What on earth am I going to do with it? And they're like, food carts.
You're leading me into my next question, which was like, what was the craziest story that any of the cart owners told you about the Hawthorne Asylum?
I mean, I would say the homeless man that they employed. You know, there's always a lot of details you come to find in your reporting or come to hear about in your reporting that just never end up in the article.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes for a good reason, you know, but I think, you know, I dug into that, and I mean, I had cart owners tell me that they remember him washing his teeth in the morning at like the sink in the pod, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, he lived in a shipping container, And the pod owners also told me, because I asked them, well, why is he no longer working for you? And they were like, well, he's erratic. He was erratic. So we, you know, we couldn't keep working with him anymore. And, it, you know, just, I don't really know how to, like, I don't really know what's stepping out of my bounds. But I know at least that the car owners were, like, very uncomfortable with just the dynamic going on there. And it felt, you know, one, and I think I said this in the story too, one said it felt, you know, like exploitative.
Super exploitative.
So I think that was a particular thing that, yeah.
What are the regulations that these pods must abide by?
So prior to this year, the city of Portland did have some very narrow rules for pods, which mostly had to do with like grease control, waste storage. So they had to have like trash and recycling structures, basically. But mm-hmm. they didn't go as far as to make the rules for you actually have to, the pod owners are responsible for like having trash and recycling pickup. So, you know, very narrow, like grease control, stormwater management, wastewater management, that sort of thing. But they really had no rules about trash and recycling pickup, adequate bathrooms. They, you know, pod owners weren't, they didn't have to provide electricity, pest management, you know, like potable water. I mean, very, ugh. You know, pretty basic things.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, again, the city has a very kind of narrow lens for their regulations, which is more kind of an environmental concern. And then the county stepped in. They actually started figuring out these rules like 4 years ago. 5 years ago, maybe. They were supposed to go into effect in the beginning of 2020. Then the pandemic happened, so the county, you know, postponed that. And so the new rules technically went into effect the first of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And the rules shift the burden of some of those basic responsibilities to the landlord. So that does include things like regular trash and recycling, keeping the area free of, like, you know, litter, adequate janitorial services, you know, there are stipulations about what bathrooms you have to provide depending on how much seating you have, like pretty specific things. Mm-hmm. And they've created a license essentially. So the other problem with regulation, even with the city's regulation, is because there was no database anywhere of pod owners, like no one knew who exists. It's hard to regulate when you don't know something exists, you know? So the pod license, once they find everyone and get them licensed, which is taking a long time, they'll actually have a database and do, you know, twice yearly inspections. And so I think things will drastically get better. Mm-hmm. That being said, you know, we are, 5 months into the year now, and only 10 pod owners have applied for the license out of an estimated 70 to 90. And so technically the county rules are now in effect, but until you get everyone licensed, I mean, no inspections are happening, so there's really no enforcement. So still a bit of a lapse there.
Yeah. I mean, aside from like an impending, like what's the impetus to even register?
I mean, I think that's why they're struggling, is because there isn't currently. They say they're going to start imposing penalties, civil penalties, so like financial penalties, July 1st. So, you know, that's in a month and a half for those who haven't applied for the license. So that'll be interesting. I mean, I will also say, like, the county has said that before and then hasn't done that sort of thing with other licensing programs. So whether that has, like, teeth or not, I don't really know yet.
Yeah.
You know, I think a really interesting dynamic that I didn't get a ton into is that a part of the reason why the county really wants to regulate these pod owners too is that oftentimes a lot of these cart owners are immigrants, or English is not their first language. And so there are barriers to, you know, like knowing how to, you know, being able to advocate for yourself with a landlord when, you know, English is not your first language, or you don't have a lawyer that you can retain to parse out the contract or the lease with them. So there's also this like very real power dynamic that is almost, it's not particular to like carts and pods, but it's sort of a more magnified version of a power dynamic that exists in other places, you know. But so I think that makes it a little bit easier for cart owners to be, you know, exploited.
Big thanks to my guests this week, Rachel Saslow and Sophie Peel. Thanks for joining me, and I hope that you'll join me again next week. Until then, bye!